All right, good morning to you. You're very welcome back to the programme. Now, a caller says, well, the new minister has been entitled to a ministerial pension, even though they're in position less than 10 months. Well, let me find that out for you. Greg, when you change over from euro to pound, the cost the same. 171 euro equals 147 pounds sterling. Well, that's currently as we're at now, you see, but there will be variations. But I think really the warning is that we're at that tipping point where we could see sort of cross-border trade. Maybe we're not just quite there yet. Ask Marion Harkin why we cannot take the same approach as Denmark, a state that opted out of the immigration pact and has massive success in reducing migration. 24 cans of Diet Coke, Coke Zero in Tesco, Northern Ireland, €8 with the club card, £8 with the club card, €16 plus here. Well, that's a big difference, isn't it? Reunited Ireland. Does the report, I wonder, cost the economies of scale that Ireland would be profited in regarding administration and bureaucracy and double services, especially in health, council services, civil services, etc.? EU support funding. Does it include the benefit to mental health of a more peaceful society and the peace dividend that would attract new investors, plus the great benefit of the fact that the democratic status of the island of Ireland has been ratified by the people of Ireland at last, after being negated in 1918 when 72% of the electorate voted for United Ireland? How many billions, never mind lives, have been unnecessarily lost because of that terrible decision to divide Ireland? It is a detailed report. It does discuss British funding, EU funding, and what have you. Right, okay. Let me see. So the son of the most pro-British Taoiseach Ireland has ever had has produced a report to say a united Ireland is not financially viable. Now there's a surprise. Well, that's not the conclusion of the report. The report, which is independent and not from this one single individual, is actually to lay out the costs so people can discuss it and have the debate. But they go on to say, love to hear a balanced debate on what he based that on. Also, you never mentioned the report that showed that insurance payouts are down by one third and premiums are up by 8%. The minister commenting calls that a success and says that he'll continue to work hard to bring down premiums. No doubt the same as he's working hard for defective concrete homeowners and young people looking to buy houses. A number of comments on the future of Crease. I'll get to those in a moment. Another caller says economic reports are twisted to suggest unity is impossible. Why is Greg believing the ESRI reports for government? Is Greg anti the reunification of Ireland? No. It's a report that has been conducted and the research and the backup is there. I don't know what it means. I'm not sure. Is 20 billion a year? Does that mean we can't afford it? The country can afford it. Potentially, we afforded COVID. We afforded the bank bailout. The bank bailout proved that we could actually afford this because that was a multiples of billions in a very short period of time. We're talking 20 billion a year. So it's just where the conversation is going to be, the practicalities of it. Even, you know, the delivery of cancer services in the Northwest, would that be Derry? Would that be Letterkenny? Would that be both? Who would travel where? So on and so forth. Just the realities of merging two countries run very differently together. I don't know why we should shy away from such a conversation, or even by having it could be deemed as being anti-reunification, but there we are. Now, our next guest on the programme is Dr. Diane Daly, Director of Physical Analysis at Forensic Science Ireland. Good morning to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning.
It's great to have you with us. Can you talk to us about the work of Forensic Science Ireland before we talk about some advances in the work that is done there?
Sure, Greg. Forensic Science Ireland is going to celebrate its 50th year next year. We were founded in 1975 with 2 to 3 people. And in those 50 years, we have grown to employ over 210 people in the laboratory. Our staff are scientists, so science graduates. We have forensic scientists and we have forensic analysts. And then we also have a team of administrative staff that help us move exhibits around the laboratory and to issue our reports. And in a typical year in Forensic Science Ireland, we get somewhere in the region of 23,000 cases. And that's broken down into roughly around 10,000 cases where they are looking for drugs and toxicology analysis. around 6,500 where they're looking for DNA analysis, and then 6,500 where they're looking for the physical methods, which is the area that I'm the director over. And in that area, we look at fingerprints analysis primarily, chemistry cases, and documents and handwriting. And chemistry cases are trace evidence cases, and they would involve things like fire accelerants, firearm residue, paint, flex, fibres, glass, and footwear analysis.
All very important elements, particularly the physical side, well, not exclusively, but particularly the physical side of things when building a case. Because often we would have Gardaí on, say, for an example, Deanne, whereby they've arrested someone and it seems like, well, it's a fait accompli, but then they would make an appeal for further information. That's also is part of building a case to ensure a conviction, I presume.
Yes. So Forensic Science Ireland sits very much as the scientists in that passage of the case through gaining enough information. And so our scientists do what we can and apply in scientific methods. We obviously are, benchmarked against the best forensic scientists in Europe, and our job is to deliver, to best international standards, independent expert opinion, advice and training, and obviously research to that criminal justice system. And our vision is science supporting justice. So we work together with An Garda Síochána, who is the investigative team, and they will submit some items to FSI and Forensic Science Ireland. And our job is to try and review those cases to see what is the best analysis that we would carry out to get the most amount of information, irrespective of whether it exonerates a person or is able to substantiate what is known facts. So for us, our job is to work with An Garda Síochána and to review those cases in order to prepare a report that forms part of the book of evidence that goes then to the Director of Public Prosecutions for them to decide as to what is the progress of all of the facts.
It's a very, very complex issue. And of course, I suppose when it's being presented in the court, it has to be complex, but I suppose also too, it has to be understandable because you are often asking 12 regular folks to sort of understand what you're saying and give weight to it.
Correct. And part of the training of the forensic scientists is that they would receive courtroom training so that they can prepare courts in what we hope is simple language and understandable language. And whilst we are technical and we have robust standards and amongst experts, we have a certain scientific language, which is very important for understanding. We also understand that when we're speaking in court as expert witnesses and delivering evidence, that it's vital that it is understood and that there's no opportunity for misinterpretation of any of the results that, that we might give. And so being a forensic scientist is really around being able to explain how significant the results are that we obtain from the tests that we do.
And, a lot of people's understanding or view or interpretation of what a forensic scientist is would have been learned from programs like CSI and others. And I think you really have, to some extent, explained that it's not really like that, that it's part there, that the forensic science is a strand of the sort of investigative process and can't sort of really stand on its own as such.
Correct. And, often perhaps people in the general public think that forensic science solves cases. And I suppose that's one aspect. We assist in investigations. And what we have technology, so something like databases. So obviously we have a DNA database and we have a fingerprint database. So we have tools at our fingertips in order to help us to get investigative leads. But the investigative lead needs to sit in the context of the case. And the example of that would be the cold case there, the murder of Nora Sheehan. And, in the reporting of that and the bringing of that case to trial, it was very much part of, understanding that Noel Long was in the area at the time. So then the forensic sits around what was recovered from the clothing of Nora, the fibres that were found to be matching the carpet in the car, and then also the paint then also matching paint flecks in the car. But altogether, those investigative leads from the paint analysis, the fibre analysis, some DNA analysis was carried out, as well as Noah Long being in the area. So it's a composite picture that's brought together. And, you know, that really is science supporting justice. Mm-hmm. We're working together with the investigative teams from An Garda Síochána Síochána. And sometimes the approach from An Garda Síochána Síochána is that they're seeking our assistance. For instance, where we apply, the tool of a database to help them find some investigative leads where they have nothing. And then other times our job is to corroborate what the facts that they have established, and also to exonerate people.
Okay, and in the case of Noel Long and the murder of Nora Sheehan, in terms of sort of fibre analysis and paint analysis, I presume, like, we're talking, you could potentially, I'm not sure in this case, talking almost microscopic materials that's being analysed here.
Yes. So in forensic science, we have a term called trace, and trace evidence can be explained as a small amount of material in the presence of a bulk amount of material. It can also be a tiny fleck. So a paint fleck and a fibre in microscopic size of detail. And so you need precision from your forensic scientist in order to observe the fibres and to recover that trace evidence from clothing that's submitted for examination. And then you need that detailed observations and examinations with the help of low power and high power microscopes, where they can help you differentiate and discriminate that trace evidence from background source.
And you have to be so detailed, didn't it, don't you? Because, you know, people on the other side of the case, they also have access to experts potentially that will try and discredit such information. You know, it's not just taken as fact all the time. Do you know what I mean? So it has to be scientifically robust and provable and demonstrable, or else it could just be untangled in the courtroom.
Correct. Any report and any examinations that forensic science conduct is open to review by a defence scientist on the side of the defence. What we do in order to maintain our standards is that all our scientists participate in proficiency trials and competency. We have ongoing professional development. We're networked with other European network forensic institutes, and our scientists attend meetings at least once a year in their chosen area of trace evidence, where it's an opportunity for science to discuss the science amongst peers and to benchmark your procedures and also to benchmark your results and to know that you are, as we say, providing robust scientific methods to the best technology available for the citizens of Ireland.
So obviously there's a huge workload, as you've mentioned, and I presume a lot of those are recent and current cases, and we have been referencing what can be described as a cold case. So with advances in technologies, you know, the pressure comes on, does it, from investigative Gardaí, you know, that one case that wasn't solved, or even there could be people listening to us right now you know, believe someone was responsible for a crime against them or someone in their family, and they're listening now and going, right, okay, well, if there's advances in sort of technology or how we do things, can we relook at that case? So in other words, you know, advances can create issues as well in terms of how do you or who determines, you know, what cold case can be revisited with effect.
Well, Greg, I think that's a very good question that you posed there, because the way the cold case reviews happen is that it's very much part of a review by the Garda Investigative Cold Case Review Team and forensic scientists together sitting down. And what they do is they each bring their expertise and they review each case and its own particular circumstances, because there are limitations and opportunities with cold cases. And so the opportunities are to re-examine exhibits and items, or to re-examine samples that were taken at the time, and we can apply advances that have been made in with the passage of time. And those advances can be that you've better instrumentation, something like a better microscope gives you a clearer image, and maybe a digital output, and you can do much more and process samples in a faster time. However, the limitations to case reviews is that we do many more cases in Forensic Science Ireland than we actually get that one success that could bring a case such as the murder of Nora Sheehan. So yes, Forensic Science Ireland is all the time reviewing cases along with the Garda investigative team to choose the ones where they will benefit from those advances in technology, because modernity is fine, but you can't do it in retrospect. You must, you know, what we have to say is, what do we have? Does this case afford itself to be one that we could have a success with?
Well, with all and that in mind too, how good are we, Diane, and I'm not asking you to be critical of people you might work with, whatever, but historically, how good are we at storing evidence whereby it can be accessed and also it's stored in a way where there is no sort of potential cross-contamination? I presume from now going forward, we have to be very good at it. I just don't wonder, I mean, we've seen some very high profile cases where some very large pieces of evidence have disappeared off the face of the earth. But are we? How have we been historically in A, you know, storing and retaining evidence that can be maybe returned to, and also B, in a way that this cross-contamination doesn't perhaps destroy potential evidence?
Yeah, well, the chain of custody and the preservation of evidence through the passage of time is definitely one of the challenges of cold cases, because people retire, people move jobs, and so, you know, some of the information specific to cases can be lost with the passage. People can die, Garda members, forensic scientists, unfortunately. So it is obviously one of the challenges of cold case review, and that's where, I mean, we have to look at the case circumstances in the round and choose which ones are the ones that we can actually get to a point where if there is advances and more results and new results are obtained, that there is the potential then to take this case through to prosecution. And that would be part of the, you know, discussions with obviously the DPP and the Garda investigation teams and ourselves. So preserving the continuity, and we, you know, like everything, we get better of these things once awareness is raised. So whilst you and I are talking about cold cases today, cold cases have been going on in Forensic Science Ireland for a while now and within Garda Síochána. So I think already the thought processes are turned to, we must preserve as much evidence as we can in certain cases where there is the potential for advances at some point in time to be able to assist.
And just very finally, has artificial intelligence entered this space for us yet? Do you anticipate that it will? I mean, obviously a lot of this stuff now, you know, you need that human touch, but I presume there are areas where, you know, this, I don't think there is an area actually where AI will not have a role into the future. Is that being discussed amongst you and your peers at this point?
AI is something that is being discussed. Like you said, it's not fully implemented yet in any aspect of forensic science. But where most advances might be seen in AI that we could see maybe be in the emergence of it in forensic science is possibly in document examination and handwriting examination, whereby there are certain security features that it might be in a passport to authenticate that is a genuine Irish passport. And sometimes it does not need a human eye in order to see that those features are present or absent. So something like an AI reader, so just like a barcode reader, can scan a document, and that document can be verified by AI that all of the security features that are required to be present are there.
Okay.
So that's something that we might see coming into the future.
Yeah, for sure. Fascinating stuff. An area of you would encourage people to get involved in, is it, Diane?
Oh gosh, yes. So science, the science, technology, engineering and maths. So they're the STEM subjects that Forensic Science Ireland want young people to embrace, particularly the chemistry. I myself am a graduate of Ulster University in biological sciences, and I have a doctorate in genetics from Ulster University. So obviously a big proponent of general science degrees, getting people equipped with the basic skills of logic and decision making and good scientific judgment. And yes, FSI is recruiting on an onward basis because we have reached that 40-year cycle and we've people retiring and recruiting. And we've moved to a new purpose-built facility. And so we're also expanding our workforce.
Brilliant stuff. All right, Deanne, it's been really interesting. Thanks very much for your time.
Bye now.
Bye. That's Dr. Deanne Daly, who's Director of Physical Analysis at Forensic Science Ireland. So it's not really like CSI, the TV show. It's not terribly removed from it either. Okay, Your Voice, Your Community on the way. Now, on this week's Your Voice, Your Community, funded by Commissioner Mann, we speak to John Richard. Good morning to you, John.
Hi, good morning, Hooge. How are you?
It's good to have you on the programme. And Raj. Good morning, Raj.
Morning.
Both are members of the Tamil-speaking community in Donegal. And we're going to talk about something being launched very, very shortly. Well, I'll talk about that in a moment. But just to get to know Raj and John a little bit better. Is it John Richard or John? Is Richard your surname? Or
yeah, it's a long name. I have another name as well, but I got shot into John Richard. Yeah, so you can call me John or Richard.
Well, I'll stay with you, John. Tamil, as a language, is it simply a language? Is any language simply a language, or is there more to it?
I would say Tamil, you know, it's called as language, but we can consider Tamil as a culture. It's a tradition. It's a thought process. And it's arts form, and it has everything together. So as a Tamil, you know, we have got about 80 million people, those who speak Tamil across the world, you know, and, you know, as I said, you know, predominantly it's a language, but we can call that as a culture, tradition and art form.
And it is, Raj, spoken in many countries, southern India, Malaysia, Sri Lanka, some of Africa. So, you know, there is some common ground there, and then there's cultural differences as well. The language, we'll call it that, sort of supersedes that.
Yes, but Tamil has been spoken in quite a number of countries, and we have a place back in India called Tamil Nadu. That Tamil Nadu means the land of the Tamils. That's a place where Tamil originated, but it's spread across the world. And even if you go to Malaysia, you can speak in Tamil and they'll understand you. There may be slight variation in the accent and how they use some words, but it is the same word, language.
Same as Irish. You can speak to someone from Galway, yes, or Gaeilge, and in Donegal. Fundamentally,
yes,
it's the same, but there are variances as well.
I like the Letterkenny accent compared to, say, places like Sligo, because they talk rapid fire, which I can't. I know a friend of mine who I know for the past 22 years. I can still only follow 50% of what he says. He's from Sligo.
Now, when you moved to Donegal, where are you originally from, Raj?
I am from the state of Tamil Nadu. I come from a place called Kunnur. Mm-hmm. That is quite high up in the mountains. So I'm very comfortable living in Letterkenny.
You like our hills.
Yes.
You can
it's almost reminds
go,
me of
go
home.
Halfway up Errigal and feel just at home.
Yes.
But were you the first arrival member of the Tamil community? Because it...
Unfortunately, there were two or three other boys who had come here in 2001, but they're no longer living in Letterkenny, and they're gone to Dublin. So I think I'm the oldest
surviving member.
Surviving in terms of age as well as staying in Letterkenny.
But I would say young in thoughts.
Huh?
I would say young in thoughts.
Okay. I get you right. And so what... John, is the Donegal Tamil community then? Do you know, how do you identify each other, if you know what I mean? What's the commonality there? other than the language and what have you? Do you pray together? Do you meet up and, I don't know, talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, usually, you know, by the language, we understand and recognize each other. And also we conduct programs, you know, once a while, you know, at least three times in a year, especially during the spring season, you know, during the April. And also we usually conduct something in June or July and also in October or November. So these are the three programs, some of four programs that we get together. We have our own lunch, you know, cooked by our member community members. Sometimes we order food, and also with a lot of cultural activities that we do. This is to rejuvenate, you know, our thought process in Tamil. Also, bring in the people together to celebrate the heritage.
Does that bring you? Is that your connection to home, though, as well, to some extent? The Tamil community, obviously you live and work here in Letterkenny, but I mean, obviously we all sort of want to retain our cultures and what have you. Is this your connection to home? Is that how it feels for you?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So what we want, you know, any tradition or any culture should be protected and, you know, preserved, right? Even though we move out from our motherland to another place, we have to protect our culture and the language. So as we move on, sometimes people turn to forget the language, but by the language only we can identify ourselves, and also the culture brings in kind of heritage to us. So we wanted to connect in that way.
Well, the language is in good standing with 80 million speakers worldwide. Is it in decline? Is it static? Is its usage increasing, I wonder?
It used to be declined, but now, for, you know, people got awareness and people moved elsewhere. They are, you know, they have started protecting the language. You know, that you would heard about. You know, we have our Tamil book written in you know, Ireland. That is from Donegal. I would say I am the author. Proudly say that, in a way that the language is being protected. It's not declined, but what we wanted to ensure is, you know, unlike any other language, we have to make sure that is spoken.
It's
written.
Used. If, yeah. Use it or lose it.
Correct. We don't want to lose it. Yeah.
Raj, you've been here for a very long time now. You moved to Letterkenny 22 years ago. Obviously, you know, other people that you knew at the time have decided to go to the city or wherever. Right. Why did you choose Letterkenny, or what drew you to Letterkenny? Did you come for a job, or did you come seeking work? Or because it is a big change.
Yes, because before coming to Ireland, I was working in Singapore. And at that time, I got to know one of my friends was working here in Letterkenny.
Yes.
So that's how I came and joined Pramerica in those days. That time I had no idea about Ireland. When I just know it is just near the UK, that's all. So when I came here, that was the reason, just for a job. So I came here. And at that time, there were only about four of us who spoke Tamil. And we'd be thrilled to hear Tamil being spoken like in Tesco, the old Tesco, which was a small place. There once three of us were talking loudly in Tamil, we thought nobody will understand. Suddenly if somebody comes and talks to us, he says, "You speak Tamil?" I said, "Yes." And we thought he was from India. He was actually from Malaysia. So he also spoke. So there were two people from different countries speaking the same language.
And John, you'll be here 10 years next year. Did you come for work in Optum, or what interested you about Ireland?
I came to work for Pramerica, now it is TCS, right? Tata Consultancy Services. I was not looking for a job, but looks like my profile was on LinkedIn and Pramerica was looking for a person like my, you know, my expertise. And they were searching for a kind of expertise for 6 months. They couldn't find. Finally, the HR from Pramerica contacted me over the phone. Then I thought, yeah.
Well, you weren't in Ireland at that point.
No.
You were living at
in India.
India, and they contacted you from LinkedIn and said, "We've a position here."
Yeah, correct. Yeah, you know, I lived in Malaysia for quite a while, maybe eight years. Then I moved into Hyderabad, and we were looking for some opportunity to explore the Western world.
Yous are both of you are from a different cultural background, right? what's it, and both even yourselves are probably from different cultural backgrounds, but what is it like moving in? I'll ask you, Raj, first. What is it like moving then into sort of, you know, a completely different sort of environment where people dress differently, they act differently, they behave differently, they speak differently? What's that experience like?
I would say I didn't find much of a difference.
Okay.
Because the place where I come from, Kunnur, the school where I studied, it was run by a group of brothers. They were known as the Brothers of St. Patrick.
Okay.
So they were the Patrician brothers. I think they're based in Kildare. They're the people who came and started the school. So we got used to the way they dress, and we also following the same thing. So I didn't find it much of a...
Yeah, you'd already had been exposed to it.
So, and also because that was the school where they were teaching us in English. So due to that, I learned my English from the very first standard till I...
From people from Kildare.
Yes.
Okay, that's right. It is a small world, isn't it?
Okay. It's very small. I never ever thought of coming here. And suddenly I find out the Brothers of St. Patrick are based in Ireland.
Yeah.
So I have also some interesting story about myself. You know, actually, I was baptized by a Irish missionary who served in my village.
Yes.
My village is very down south in Tamil Nadu. And they had the missionaries from Ireland, France and everywhere. So for John Clayton, who is, I think, I'm not too sure exactly where he's from. I heard that he's from Galway area. And he gave me the name John Richard.
Oh, wow.
And my parents wanted to include the name as Arokia, right? So that's how maybe...
So what is your whole name, your full name?
John Arokia Richard, right? Okay. Three names. And also we write our father's name as a surname. There is no surname concept in Tamil Nadu. So we use our father's name as a surname. My father's name is Ritu. So usually people turn to call me as Ritu as my father's name. Then I usually tell, no, my name is John Richard. If you want to call us Richard or John, you can call either way.
Yeah, they're interchangeable, really, if you choose. Okay. Now, the Tamil speaking community are having a charity event in the Regional Cultural Centre on Saturday the 13th of April. It's in aid of the Donegal Hospice. It's sold out, though, isn't it, Raj?
Yes.
Okay, so this full capacity, time, right?
This is the very first time this Donegal Tamil Vila, that means Donegal Tamil Festival, we are having it, and it's been sold out. And one good thing is because the community is small in numbers in Letterkenny, but large in heart. When they knew it was supposed to go, the entire proceeds of the ticket sales is going to the Donegal Hospice. We decided we are going to do it. A few of us, about five of us, formed the core committee, and we are sponsoring the entire event. So whatever money comes from the Tamil community is going directly to the Donegal Hospice. Mm-hmm. We always try to give back to the community wherever we are.
No, and I know in the past you raised money for the Chrysler tragedy,
yes.
And also other charitable causes, both inside and outside of Ireland. It really is quite fascinating. I'm sure there are those that dispute it, but the school of thought is that Tamil is the first known language to humans. So once we got up onto our feet, this is the language.
I always like to be...
One of them, save arguments, thing. Raj.
One of the oldest.
You're just trying to save arguments here, okay.
No, but that is this language has been... We still have... It's still spoken the same way. Even if you compare 500 years, somebody from about 500 years ago, if he appears here and talks to me in Tamil, I'll be able to understand him and he'll be able to understand me.
So there is, and it's, we believe it to be a first, a book written from the shores of Atlantic Ireland. The Atlantic of Ireland is the English translation, but this is thought to be the first Tamil book by a Tamil author living in Ireland, and it's going to be in the Irish Public Library, John.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So I used to write poems since my college days, you know, effectively, and after I moved in Ireland, you know, I put in a lot of efforts to write more poems as well as the articles, you know. I frequently write in social media as well. So one of my friends told me that, why not you publish a book? Because most of the writings about Ireland and also my thought process from Ireland to connect my homeland. So, you know, I would have written about 500 to 600 poems. From 500 to 600 poems, I selected about 100 poems and published, you know. I got a good good opportunity from Donald Kelly, you know, who
the
was
councillor, yeah.
Yeah, then mayor. You know, I went and attended a literature event in one of the hotels. I forgot the name, sorry. Then he asked me, do you write poems? Yes, I write poems. Have you published a book? Yeah, I published a book. Then he asked me, why can't you try in library? Because there is an opportunity for your book to be accepted in the library. Then I approached the library, the librarian. He said, welcome, most welcome.
Okay.
Because this must be the first Tamil book from Donegal, maybe in Ireland. So we can definitely proudly present that in the library. That's how it went in.
Brilliant. Okay, yeah. Well done. Congratulations. Yeah. It's a fine achievement. Good luck with the event that's taking place. I'm sure, as you say, we've mentioned the charity events. What is happening at that event? Of course, it's only the 250 people, Raj, that we'll be able to see because it's sold out. But what will take place? I presume poems.
We are getting performers from outside Letterkenny to come and perform here, because till this year, always the events used to be in-house. We get the families to get their children and they come and do the dance, song and dance, everything. But this time we thought, okay, let them all come here to relax and enjoy something so that they'll get to know about the Tamil culture. Because we speak Tamil, but some of these art forms are slowly getting forgotten.
Mm.
So now we are trying to bring them back. So
yeah, which brings me back to the very first question: is it a language or is it much more? And it's to retain the much more.
We consider Tamil as a living language, and it will surprise you, but we do have a temple dedicated to Tamil back in India.
Mm-hmm.
We call it Mother Tamil.
Mm-hmm.
So that is sort of, it encompasses everything, all art forms, language, everything is there.
Brilliant.
Greg, one more information.
Of course, go ahead, John.
Yeah, one more information on that, right? So if you look at the Tamil traditional musical instruments, we got about 100 over instruments. Maybe only 10 or 15 are in practice right now. Maybe we have to bring back all the, traditional instruments. Mm. And also the dance forms, we got about 25 different dance forms. And also that is also being forgotten. When we talk about dance, people would think about only, maybe the Bollywood or Hollywood dance, or Kollywood dance. We have much more beyond that. You know, we have to bring back. That's why we have identified a few people, those who do well, those kind of dances, and we are
maybe the next generation will be there and go, yeah, I would like to practice that.
That's because basically, there are a lot of boys or children who are born in Ireland, who are originally from Tamil Nadu. They might not know all these art forms. Mm. So we want to show them these are the different instruments which are being used. These are different art forms, dances, music instruments.
And you have to compete with everything else that they're exposed to
Definitely.
Don't you? It's the same. Okay, listen, Raj, it's been lovely having you in. Raj, a member of the Tamil-speaking community, the man of many names, John, Richard, Rashi. I won't try any others.
Yeah.
Also a member of the Tamil-speaking community, an author and poet who writes in Tamil as well and has his book present in the library as well, which is a proud achievement, I think, for you and your family. Both of you, thanks very much. It's been interesting, really interesting, and keep us updated with any future events. It's been lovely having both of you on.
Thanks.
That's Raj and John. That was Your Voice, Your Community, and we're back with more on the 9 till noon show after the break. You heard us referencing a report earlier on as it relates to the cost of a United Ireland. Trinity College professor and report author, Professor John Fitzgerald, joins me on the programme now. John, thank you so much for your time today. I'm sure you're in great demand.
No problem.
Now, I'm not sure if this is public perception or how it's been presented in the media, but a number of contacts to us feel that this is kind of like an anti-unification document, which I am sure it's not. But can you understand, as when we start talking about the cost per year, increased taxation, less spending, that some people might perceive it as such?
Yes, I can understand that. Now, I don't have a position on Irish unification. I'd be dead before it happens. So it's of less immediate interest. So there have been a series of papers, and this is one of a series, which look at what the cost would be. But of course, cost is only one issue. But I think it is important that if people are going to consider having a referenda on unification, that they do consider the cost as well as all the other benefits and costs.
Yes, because as I said on the show earlier, but I've said it for years now at this stage, it might be, you know, loyalism, unionism, nationalism that might trigger the process. But really, I think an awful lot of the debate and conversation is going to be on the practicalities of this. You know, when we get into the nitty gritties, that's probably what people will be voting on.
The conclusion of this paper and other papers is that there is a big gap in output per head in between Northern Ireland and the Republic. And Northern Ireland could do a lot to change that by, in particular, reforming their education system, and there are other changes that they need to make. If they make those changes, the benefits would occur over the next 20 years, which would narrow the gap very substantially. It would make a united Ireland easier and less costly, or it would make for a much more successful Northern Ireland within the United Kingdom. You don't have to take a unionist position or a Republican position. Changing Northern Ireland to make it work is good for everybody.
But it's how quickly that change might happen, either in advance or after. You know, we could look to the likes of Germany, I suppose. That's an example as to how two different societies merged in terms of, you know, cost of living or wages and all that type of stuff. It's how it's done as well, really, isn't it? How did you factor that in?
Yeah, well, we're only looking at the immediate change. If you transfer from dependent on the UK Treasury for funding Northern Ireland to transferring to the people of Ireland funding themselves, what the effects would be. Over a 20-30 year period, there would be major changes, and there'd be things that would go well, there are things that would be more difficult. So we're looking at the immediate costs. The overall economic effects are more complicated, and we're not considering that.
That being said, even at 20 billion a year, we probably could afford it, because we've been able to dig pretty deep in the past, that will be to a great expense to the public. But also, too, there would be some benefits, but some disadvantages. Some of that more difficult to work out?
The immediate effects would be pretty expensive. Financial bailout costs Ireland a minimum of 60 billion. You're talking about 20 billion a year. So it's a bailout every 3 years over a period of 10 to 20 years. That's a lot of money. There are other political and social effects which you've got to take into account, and which no doubt people in voting would take into account. But the fact that your standard of living is going to be substantially reduced in this part of the island would be something that people would need to take into consideration in terms of when and if there is Irish unification.
You talked of, you know, believing this happening in your lifetime. I think there's plenty of life in you yet. So what realistically, the closer we get to it, potentially, do we end up pushing it out because of the complex nature of it?
If Northern Ireland got its act together today and made the necessary changes, you'd see a major improvement in productivity and a narrowing of the gap in 20 years. And at that stage, the costs of unification will be substantially reduced. But action has to be taken today. Like, there's research done by Vanni Barua, leading academic economist in Northern Ireland, the SRI last year, Seamus McGuinness, Emer Smith, all of which points to problems in the educational system. We reformed, the Northern Ireland had a better education system than the Republic up to 1970. We brought in free secondary education with equal access. So if you're in Creaslick or Coot Hill or Chapel Izzet, you have equal opportunities. In Northern Ireland, at the age of 11, 60% of kids are sent to secondary schools where they're not really expected to go on to third level, and a large number drop out. That is a huge cost to society in Northern Ireland. So they need to integrate their grammar schools and secondary schools, a very difficult challenge for them. If they do that and provide equal opportunities in education, You'll see the benefits 20 years on, because we made the change in 1970 and you see the Celtic Tiger in the 1990s. So it takes time for the kids who are being failed by the system today to be succeed in the system and grow up and then enter the labour market. That's why it's a long term project. The one thing which Northern Ireland could do rapidly is an awful lot of their graduates are people who kids who went to university in England and don't come back. And the research shows it's the nature of the divided society is one of the things that stops them coming back. And if Sinn Féin and the DUP and Alliance got together and managed to persuade those graduates to come back to Northern Ireland, it could transform the economy and the society. But you have to persuade. Mm. You can't. This isn't just about money. It's about saying Northern Ireland is a great place to be rather than in England.
Mm-hmm. I get you. Fascinating, Professor, and so much more we could dig into if we had more time, but we don't. My thanks for you for your time this morning. Take care. That's Professor John Fitzgerald there.